This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. The 19th century sex trade in Fargo is one of the elements in a new collection of essays titled Historical Sex Work, New Contributions from History and Archaeology. Angela Smith, an associate professor of history at NDSU, is one of the volume's co-editors. The book examines the sex trade in America from 1850 to 1920, and it features lesser-known cities to tell stories about people often excluded from history. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talked with Smith.
Dr. Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So a book like this, I would not have expected to come out of a semester-long class project. Let's start there. Mm-hmm. What was the project that your students were working on back in 2013?
It was for an Intro to Museum Studies course, and my students and I did an exhibit called Taboo Fargo Moorhead. And the students went out and we tried to find things that were taboo. And so we went down a lot of paths, honestly. And one of the things that one of my students, or actually two of my students, found was this report of this madam who got arrested again and again and again in the 1890s in Fargo. And it said that she was, you know, fined for running a house of ill fame. And so that was the beginning of this research. I mean, the entire book comes out of that core research, that there was a woman there thinking about prostitution and sex workers in the history of Fargo and then more broadly in the history of the Northern Midwest and the Great Plains.
Well, I do want to spend a lot of time focusing on her. Her life is very fascinating, but I think we should start a little bit broader. In terms of the approach that you and your fellow researchers took with this book, what do you think that you bring to this body of research that hasn't already been published?
So historians and historical archaeologists, these are two separate fields. Historical archaeology comes in the anthropology, archaeology field. And historians are doing, I mean, these are, if you're thinking Venn diagrams, these are circles that overlap sometimes, but there's rarely a conversation between the historians and the historical archaeologist as a field. And then you dig down a little bit deeper and you think about specific areas of study, such as historic sex work. And there had been no conversation between the two groups. So historical archaeologists, they go and they dig. And they have been finding really interesting things in all kinds of areas that had, you know, brothels in places like Boston and places like Washington, D.C. and L.A., where these digs have revealed really interesting material. But historians have not been working with them to kind of deepen the approach to those fields. And we found, because Kristen Fellows, my partner in this project, this overlap really helped us, because in 2016, when they started excavating for the new City Hall, we knew that was the place where Melvina Massey's brothel had been. And so we started pushing and working together. And so that idea helped us consider that we need to push this forward and open a conversation between the two fields.
Were both sides equally intrigued? Was, working together, did it come naturally?
It came naturally for us. It doesn't necessarily come naturally. The silos that are in higher education, because we weirdly compete for resources, particularly in the humanities and the social sciences. There's just not a lot of money in singular universities or across these fields. It doesn't cost a lot to run humanities programs, but there's not, when you think about the way that it falls and what has happened in the last 25 or 30 years with higher education funding has been diminished. It's not grown, it's been diminished. So there's weird competition there for financial resources. That kind of keeps us apart, not here, not necessarily in Fargo and NDSU, but it keeps us apart generally. We wanted to change that and work together because everything was complementary. The other co-editor for our volume is Anna Munns, and Anna was one of Dr. Fellow's graduate students. And it was her contribution is amazing to this, again, showing how if we work together, Anna picked up for me. She took a museum studies class with me, and pushing, a collaboration is something that we believe is really important. And we modeled that in this project.
How do you do this type of research? Because, of course, as you're going back in the historical record, you run into things all of the time, like broken records and paper trails and conflicting eyewitnesses' accounts. And then you add on this layer of it being a taboo to do sex work and people actively changing their names, moving locations, trying to stay hidden. Because this is the black market, that's just how that works.
Right.
So how do you do this research?
Well, there are overt records, in part because of the nature of the laws. When you think about Fargo in the 1890s, a lot of the revenue for the city came through the fines that the city imposed on the red light district. It was a red light district. There were brothels, there were cribs, there were these long row houses that we can see on the, when we look at the Sanborn maps, which were fire insurance maps put out by the Sanborn Company, what they did, the way this worked, is the company would send somebody in and he would explain, or he or she, I'm pretty sure it wasn't he, but they would draw the houses and what the houses were made of. And it would be a particular color. But you can see from that how many stories it had, how many rooms it had. And it would also say FM for female boarding, which that's code for a brothel. So you can see that on the record. So you know that those houses were part of the red light district. And then you start to look at the police records and you put these things together so that you can trace not necessarily the who, but the how. And they tried in a couple of times in Fargo history, they tried to do away with the red light district in the late 1890s. But, the madams had some clout and it didn't really fade away until the late teens. Probably 1913 to 1920, it started to fade away, or the houses were being shut down. Melvina Massey's house was shut down in 1910.
Well, you talk about the clout that the madams have, and you talked about this as a revenue for the city. It was the second biggest revenue stream, just behind the general tax for the city of Fargo, at least for a time. And it's a fascinating read about agency and female agency. And a lot of this work grew out of after the Civil War, when men died in massive amounts, leaving behind families who women didn't have a role in the traditional workforce. And then, of course, it's a post-slavery world, and black women are taken directly from slavery and into, I'm not sure if I want to use the word sex slavery in a conversation about agency, but they are sort of linked together. So I want to talk about this from the perspective of agency for women, and women who were able to make money and retain some sort of autonomy at this time.
Well, I argue, particularly with Malvina Massey, because she was an African-American woman who was born before the Civil War and more than likely had been a slave, that her ability to make decisions and support herself through this line of work is impressive. It's impressive to me. It's not a situation where she was at somebody else's call, where they had power over her. She clearly made her own decisions. And you can see, because there are some affidavits from her, kind of her take and how many times she hired lawyers. She had a huge amount of agency voice in that she had to take care of herself and to, to keep her business. She also broke the rules, and she clearly was, she did not bow down to whatever the powers that were in Fargo during that time. Which is interesting, the rebellion she was clearly rebellious against the forces, and mostly that were trying to stop her from selling alcohol, because North Dakota was dry after statehood. They could not sell alcohol, but she sold alcohol in her establishment, and she pushed back against that. She sold out alcohol in her establishment, got caught more than once.
It was interesting to me how much of the book really dealt with the vice of alcoholism versus the vice of sex work. And, with a title like Historical Sex Work, you'd think the book would just kind of be about that sex work. But really, you mentioned it's interdisciplinary already, but it's also, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, an fourth wave feminism or intersectional feminist look at sex work, in that you do take into account different races and study how they are portrayed as sex workers and madams, and how they are treated differently within the legal system. I want to talk about Malvina Massey because, the title of the chapter is Fargo's Most Famous Madam. What was so interesting to me about her was that she seemed comfortable anyway exploiting racist stereotypes.
Yes. She is not, sometimes we think about, when we imagine the past, especially post-Civil War, we, as historians even, even though we try to find the nuance and try to see the differences, we also understand how much African Americans had going against them after the Civil War. After the Civil War, 4 million formerly enslaved people were free, but they did not have land. They didn't have a way to make a living. They didn't have a mule. I remember one of my early research projects that I had when I was in grad school was looking at a particular land that had been part of a Civil War battlefield, and that I found the first deed of an African American buying a mule in 1865. And, you know, there was a record at the courthouse about this man buying a mule. And so they didn't have any of those things. And when I think about, you know, so the key core things we need to survive, they did not have. So they had to figure out a way to get those things. So when I think about Melvina Massey, which she was alive during that time, I have tried, and there may be more evidence out there. I know her, one of her descendants, her great, 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 four greats, I believe, grandson has also been doing a lot of research. He lives in Rhode Island. And we've been looking for evidence, particularly in Virginia, to figure out what happened to her. I can, in my chapter in the book, I conjecture that perhaps she went to Washington, D.C. Perhaps she went to a camp, you know, right before the end of the Civil War. And there's little pieces because of where her father lived after the war. And for the next in the 1880 census, he lived in Falls Church, Virginia. And so I've done a lot of digging around there, but still we don't have any solid information about exactly what her status was and what she was doing. But you can imagine, because of the way her life, when she finally got to Fargo, the way she lived, that she's not a victim. You know, I cannot see her. I know enough about her. I cannot see her as a victim. She has ingenuity about the way she approaches her business. She's not afraid to use the legal system. So when you think about going back to thinking about the end of the Civil War and what that was like for African Americans and formerly enslaved people, and look at her and what became of her life, it is hard to see her as, for me anyway, as anything but smart and driven, even if it involves sex work. The other piece that I argue is, if you are owned by another human being, if your body, especially as a woman, if your body is owned by another human being, doesn't that change the way you see sex work in that, particularly in that period? I mean, sex work that you can get money for it, for having sex with a stranger. And look at the relationship between those two things. Somebody owns your body and you do something that you have some control over. That's one of the things, the big points that I argue in my chapter, is that we have to see that in a different frame. She was not a victim.
It sounds too like, in terms of being a sex worker, working for her was at least as comfortable as it could be. She paid her women a salary. Yes. And, you know, we tend to think of a lot of stereotypes as these women being absolutely just bullied and beaten and owned by pimps. And that is certainly true of a lot of the sex trade. But I am curious about, is hierarchy of sex work really the right term to use? Like, for example, if someone is going into or was in sex work at that time, what would be a difference in the quality of life if you were at a brothel, if you were a streetwalker?
Well, that's what Anna argues in her chapter about the language that they use in the police records about the women and what the charges were. And you know, she kind of delineates in that chapter the breakdown of the hierarchy, and there was breakdown. Melvina Massey owned her own brothel. She had a room that was down, you know, that was on the main floor. It wasn't on the top floor, which is where, you know, that we found the plans for the house. And upstairs was cookie cutter rooms. And because we have her her will that has an inventory, we know what was in all of those rooms, and they were exactly the same kind of bed, the same kind of table next to it, a washstand. So we know that every one of those rooms on the top floor were exactly alike. Her room was on the main floor, and it was on the floor, and Dr. Fellows makes this argument in her chapter about masculine spaces and the way that Melvina Massey designed her brothel so that it appealed to men in a particular way that brought out the feeling for them of masculinity, but because of the things that they had in her, it that was on the ground floor where there was a dance floor, that there was a place for men to lounge. And so that becomes part of that argument as well, that, you know, she designed this space to appeal to men in a particular way.
What do you think we love about studying taboo?
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe for myself is there's two things. The first is we want to know what is not clearly visible to us. You know, what happened in the small corner of something that is illicit, that is, you know, titillating, honestly. But it's also trying to imagine another space and time where all the ways we think about things today are not exactly the same, and trying to figure out what are the constructs that mattered at that point. And I think, you know, it's historical thinking to take us there. And as a public historian, that matters to me. I mean, the amount of interest for the 2017 exhibit was amazing. There were like 250 people at the opening. It was huge. People are really interested in this. High Plains Reader did a story on it. So, you know, it's good for public historians because it engages people in history.
Dr. Smith, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Ashley Thornburg in a conversation with NDSU history professor Angela Smith about the book she co-edited about the sex trade in America over a century ago. Coming up on Main Street, a commentary about the aftermath of the presidential election from Mark Trahant and a discussion with an expert on special education. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Public Service Commission will hear a dispute between two electric companies over who will provide power to a new truck stop being built near Drayton. The Love's truck stop will be west of I-29 in Drayton. Otter Tail Power, an investor-owned utility, and Nodak Electric Cooperative provide electric service in that area. Nodak says Otter Tail Power did not go through the proper procedure in asking the PSC for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to provide that service.
Nodak further alleges that the system extension by Otter Tail Power would interfere with Nodak's service and system would be a wasteful duplication of facilities.
PSC Chairman Brian Crosha says this is a Territorial Integrity Act case in that Nodak already serves the area and did so before the city of Drayton annexed the land.
It's an attractive load when you look at electric usage for the truck stop, and you have an attractive load. There always seems to be more interest from utilities in serving that customer. And of course, the cooperative contends that that is within their territory, that they should be able to serve the customer.
A hearing will be held December 8th. The State Investment Board is looking at investing more of the Legacy Fund within the state of North Dakota. State Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried is a member of the board, and he's been pushing for such a study. A recent survey of economic developers shows overwhelming support for investing Legacy Fund money within the state, and there has been talk of an initiated measure to require that 100% be invested here. Gottfried says he wants to keep the conversation going.
We've talked about this on the State Investment Board a number of times, and it's always seemed to kind of fizzle out in terms of, you know, should we do more in investment in North Dakota? And we'll hear from our fund managers and they'll say, well, it isn't prudent because you'll be overly saturated in North Dakota. That, again, it goes back to what's the purpose of the Legacy Fund, what's the meaning of it. So I think by keeping this conversation fresh and alive is really going to hopefully help move it forward and get to a good result.
The legislature's Legacy and Budget Stabilization and Advisory Board will also be discussing the issue at its meeting on Thursday. And a large-scale search is underway in Becker County for a missing hunter. Sheriff Todd Glander says the man was to meet up with his hunting party for lunch at 11:30 but didn't show up. That group notified authorities around 3:30 yesterday afternoon that the 57-year-old from the Twin Cities could not be found. A ground search continued until midnight and resumed this morning.
It's not real conducive for aerial right now. We did have a plane from the State Patrol last night that assisted us, and they had to leave because of weather rolling in. And it was over 60 degrees when I got here last night, and when I stepped out of the truck this morning, it was 31.
Trackers from the White Earth Tribal Police Department, several fire departments, and volunteers from the area are out in the search along the Becker and Clearwater County line northwest of Bad Medicine Lake. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a regular on our show. He's the editor of Indian Country Today, and before that, he taught journalism at the University of North Dakota. Today, he offers a commentary about the election and the controversy surrounding the results.
Every story published about the election gets an instant comment from supporters of President Donald Trump. The election is not over, they write. There are legal challenges ahead. The media doesn't call elections. The courts will. That packs in a lot of ideas. The news media doesn't really determine elections. That's true. But we do report results, and the math is the math. It's a system that has worked pretty well for more than a century. Yes, you could use the standard of certification, but most states take 30 days or more after the counting is completed, and that could be mid-December. That's also the deadline for the Electoral College to meet and vote. Waiting is a problem because it means less time to organize a new government. And at all levels of government, once the news media does the math, transition planning begins. Even in this election, every single congressional race was called by the media, often moments after the polls close. Not a single member objected. But this president is different. The damage he is doing is to the country and to the essential operation of government. The legal challenges are the political equivalent of a lottery ticket. Yes, he could win. Something that everyone who buys a lottery ticket says, too. President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris celebrated their win Saturday and are beginning a transition anyway. It's worth noting, this is history. Harris is the first woman, the first daughter of immigrants, the first black woman. She is shattering the glass ceiling. The Biden team promises more of that, assembling a diverse cabinet, one that could even include a Native American for the first time in history. The possibilities range from a Secretary of the Interior to the United Nations Ambassador. There is one more message from this election. The United States remains a divided country. More than 70 million people voted for Trump, and 75 million voted for Biden. The challenge going forward is for the next president and Congress to govern with that fact in mind. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Next, a discussion about special education.
Power dynamics shape everything in our lives. From high school...
You're wearing sweatpants.
So?
So that's against the rules, and you can't sit with us.
To the U.S. Senate...
The senator will take her seat.
To the way we feel about ourselves.
Power does make us a little bit more self-focused.
But this can happen to us all. This is just what the mind does when we feel powerful.
This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Dana Kosowski is a special education teacher for elementary and middle school students in Wahpeton and a 2021 North Dakota Teacher of the Year finalist. Today we'll share her discussion with host Tom Gerhart for North Dakota United's Education Mindset podcast. Kosowski will talk about what drew her to working with students facing challenges with behaviors, academics, and social and emotional skills. She also mentors first-year special education teachers, and she advocates for the nurtured heart approach to make a significant difference in the lives of students.
Dana, thanks for being here. It's so nice to see you.
You too, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to congratulate you again on being a 2021 North Dakota Teacher of the Year finalist. Such an amazing honor.
Absolutely. It is just very humbling when we think about all the great educators in the state of North Dakota.
Tell me first off about your journey to where you are now in education. Is that something from a young age that you knew you wanted to do? Or how did you find your way to where you're at?
You know, I've always worked with the special needs population from when the time when I was a teenager. I worked in group homes and with some Parks and Rec youth that had special needs. Initially, I thought I was going to go to school to be an occupational therapist. And after 1 year, decided that wasn't quite for me and switched a little bit to education. So I have a bachelor's degree in elementary education and a master's in science in special education, but knew that I always wanted to go into the special education field. It took me a little bit to get there, but it's been the right fit all along.
Mm. Well, 16 years in the classroom, middle and elementary schools. And as you mentioned, you are a special education educator. What drew you to students who face challenges with behaviors, social emotional skills, and academics?
You know, I've always, it just is very satisfying and rewarding to see the growth that is made over time. I have the privilege of working with kids over across multiple years. Some of the students that I have now I've worked with since they're eighth graders now, and I've worked with them since they were in first grade, just because I made a transition at the same time that they made a transition to the middle school. So to see that growth over time is just such an amazing thing. I get to develop such deep relationships with families over that time as well. These kids are resilient and persistent and determined to improve themselves every day. And it's just an honor to be able to spend that time with them.
Another thing I saw looking at your background is that you mentor first-year special education teachers. That's amazing, too, that you're willing to step up to the plate and do that kind of work and help others succeed.
That's a lot of fun. I've enjoyed that. This is my third year of doing that in our district, and I get to mentor them through the special education paperwork process, but also in things like working with paraeducators and how best to navigate parents, or working with general education teachers and building those relationships with the general education teachers too. So it's very rewarding to see their growth over the year as well, from the beginning of the year being kind of nervous about running their first IEP meeting and wanting me to help support them in that, and then just how they grow in their own and step into their own teacher role as the year goes on. It's lots of fun to see.
Well, you've mentioned a little bit about your background and your education that led you to this point, but perusing your application, I can see that there's so much more that's gone into getting you where you are. A lot of time in the classroom, a lot of learning, a lot of sacrifice on your part. And I saw that you use something called the nurtured heart approach. I was going to have you talk about that, but then also how that has led not only to you, mentoring first-year teachers, but you were invited, another special honor, to speak at a national convention in 2019. So you have a lot of knowledge and you're willing to share with others.
Yep. The nurtured heart approach is just a kind of in a nutshell. It's a relationship approach where we really change the way we look at our focus. We're looking for what's going right in a situation, and that's what we give our energy to. And instead of saying a kid is stubborn, I'm going to say that kid is persistent, and flip that and really show them that evidence of times when they're being persistent. Or my favorite example is when my son was learning how to ride his bike, and he kept falling off, I said that he was so determined because he kept getting back on his bike, you know, time and time again. I said, Reed, you are so determined because every time you fall, you get back on your bike. 3 months later, he was trying to put on his button-up shirt for school pictures, and I was trying to help him because he was having a hard time. He says, Mom, I can do this because I am determined. So when we give kids those qualities that we see in them, we're able to pull them back out in those times that they need them. So that, in a nutshell, is about the Nurtured Heart approach, and it has transformed my teaching. I was to the point a few years ago where I didn't know if I could continue on in education. I was like burnt out. I was frustrated. I was just seeing a lot of negativity. I worked in a situation there at that time where I had students that had pretty intense behaviors. I was seeing a lot of negativity and felt like I was just running from crisis to crisis to crisis, and I would go home exhausted. And as I've learned about this approach, it's really changed how I think about things, and in turn has helped me see what's going right, even in tricky situations. It helps me be grateful for things that are going right, who is, you know, staff that are willing to jump in and help. So it's just really made a huge difference in my life. And through that, I've been able to pass it on to other people. And I'm so grateful to have that opportunity.
Tell me about speaking then at this national convention.
Yeah. I spoke at the Nurtured Heart Approach Global Summit in 2019 in West Orange, New Jersey. So I'd never been out to the East Coast. That was a cool experience. My husband and I went to New York for a few days beforehand. That was fun. But the Nurtured Heart Approach draws in people from all professions. There was educators and therapists and parents there. I spoke specifically on how Nurtured Heart Approach has really can be used to prevent teacher burnout, because I feel like without the skills that I gained through that, I'm not sure I would be in the position that I am today. So I just talked about, you know, not giving energy to negative situations and how we can really stay focused on energizing positive and what's going right in each situation. And how we can, you know, always remember why we're doing what we do when those moments get really tough. So it was a great experience. I've never spoken at a conference like that before, which it pushed me outside of my comfort zone a little bit. And I think it's always good to be pushed outside our comfort zones a little bit. So
I can tell relationships are foundational to the work that you do in and out of the classroom. And I really loved something that you wrote saying that relationships come from truly seeing others. And then a couple of words later was the word unconditional, seeing people unconditionally. Talk about that thought process. And again, obviously that's an integral part to the success you see in the classroom and with the individuals you work with.
Yeah. We have kids that have some really tricky moments sometimes, whether it's physical behaviors or verbal behaviors or just not being able to meet the expectation in the time that we need them to, so our class can proceed in a timely fashion. It can be really frustrating as an educator to have those things happen, or really, you know, when your room has something happen to it, it can be just take that moment away from you. But when we really truly see who a person is and that they're so much more than that behavior, then we can really see the underneath of who they are. And my kids know that every moment is a new moment. When something tricky happens, we take a deep breath and we move on from this moment. You know, 10 minutes ago, yeah, you may have been throwing something or yelling or swearing or whatever it might be. But at this moment, I see you sitting in your desk. I see your voice is quiet. I see you've picked up whatever needed to be picked up and you're ready to work. And this is the moment that we're going to live in. We're not going to live in the past, what's already happened. We're living in this moment today, right now. And I had a kid today say, tomorrow is going to be a better day. Like he had a rough morning. And he said, tomorrow is going to be a better day. I said, we don't need to wait till tomorrow. Like, we can choose right now to have a better moment. Like, we can choose from here on out. Whatever has happened in the past is done and over with. And I see you right now being ready to have a better day. They just know that no matter what, I'm here for them. And we move on and we're looking at what's going right. We're not going to live in the past. We're not going to live in the yuck or the trickiness. We move on with what's going right.
And I think what's so incredible about that mindset is that they can take that with them for the rest of their lives. It's not just applicable in the classroom. It could be with relationships, a job, just about anything.
Yes. How many of us adults need to remember that we don't need to wait for tomorrow to have a better day. We can choose right now to turn our day around, right? So it is definitely a life skill.
Everything you said leads up to this phrase, success focused. I mean, I can tell everything that you said points toward that, but you describe yourself as being success focused. I thought maybe you could just explain that a little bit more.
Yeah. you know, I'm always looking for any step in the right direction, a baby step towards the right direction of where I want the student to go. You know, an example would be, I had a few weeks ago, I had a student who took an AR test and he worked super hard on it and he ended up getting 5 out of 10. So we didn't get any AR points. I said, you know what? This is the first book you've ever read by yourself. So yeah, the AR test didn't go how I wanted it to, but you read this book by yourself, independently from front to back. That is a success. So, you know, next time we'll try again. And, you know, every time we practice, we get better. So we're always looking for those steps in the right direction towards growth. And we can celebrate those things. Success breeds success. I had a professor in college say that. Success breeds success. The more success that we can show kids, the more success they're going to have.
And you said you also like to celebrate special occasions. Reading your first book is certainly one of those times. Can you think of another story that you can share where, because that obviously builds those relationships, makes students feel special and like you care about them.
Yep. One thing we do in my room is when it's a student's birthday, I write their name on the board and it's happy birthday, whomever. And then I pull out character qualities that I recognize in that kid, whether it be hardworking or determined or persistent. And then they're up on the board around their name for everyone to see that day. And then other students, it's really fun. Other students will go in and add words that they see that student does. So it's just a kind of a team building, like a community building thing. I feel like I work with kids that are multiple grade levels. So in my room, I try to have it be really a family-oriented feel. Like we are there to support each other. We're there to cheer each other on and just have that relationship between students and staff. So it's fun to see.
Again, another opportunity for all of us to help see ourselves in a new light. Mm-hmm. Seeing all those words around their names, I'm sure, is really empowering for them. You know, you mentioned challenges and challenging situations, and clearly you're not afraid of running into those yourself or with your students or what may be perceived of as a failure, but using different language. And I wanted to get back to what you said about every moment being a fresh start. There's incredible power in that and freedom, isn't there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because when we can, like I said, we can't go back and change what's happened in the past. So if we just fresh start, new moment, we can move on and in the frame of mind that we want to be in from there on out and looking towards success instead of, you know, I had a student bring up yesterday something that happened. She's a seventh grader now, and something that happened when she was in third grade. I was like, we can't go back. We can't beat ourselves up about what's happened in the past. Need to move on and look how far you've come since then. You know, I have the honor of knowing them that long, and I can say, look how far you've come since then.
So it sounds like you have a rewarding and challenging job, I guess, like all educators. But I wanted to talk to you for a little bit about working in our distance learning environment and how you're able to do the things that you want to do in a distance learning and teaching situation.
Right now we are fortunate that we are full-time face-to-face in Wahpeton. In this past spring, I guess I felt like my roles were a couple different things. I have students that I teach math and reading. My other focus was on supporting students in the general education classroom, and I did that through Zoom, and we would email a lot. You know, the other important role I felt like I had as an educator last spring was connecting with parents, because I know things were pretty tricky at home for many of my parents, and so I said, as a goal, just to communicate with parents at least weekly, and often it was more than that, 2 or 3 times a week if I could, just a quick check-in, you know, what can I do to help? You know, what are you having trouble with? But I would always make sure to start the conversation with, hey, you know what? This is what I noticed about your student this week. Yeah, we're missing 4 math assignments, but they got this one turned in. So let's focus on that one that we got turned in. And the more we can build that success, the more we can move it in the right direction.
And one thing you mentioned, pointing back to last spring, was you recognized how vital our education system is.
Yes. Oh, for sure. We have concerns when we're not in school about the basic needs of our students being met. It was amazing to see how everyone came together in the spring to get lunches out to students that needed that. The counselors were doing visits to make sure that kids had internet and just the materials that they needed. Teachers working together teachers that didn't know online platforms were getting help from teachers that did. It was just such a collaborative effort. It was pretty amazing to see how that all came together in such a short time frame. It did just give me such, you know, I know no matter what we face this year, I know we can handle it because we can together as a group. Collaboratively, we are so strong.
What would you like to do with the platform that you have now as a finalist for 2021 North Dakota Teacher of the Year? I know there's a group of educators of Teacher of the Year finalists that get together and communicate and think big. Have you thought about that? Have you been able to think about what you might do or what you may want to contribute?
You know, when I think about, you know, for me, what's most important about my job is letting others know how important it is that we support our colleagues and support the staff that we work with. You know, we're there to support kids, but if we can't support each other, then they can't support kids too. This is a hard year. I have had veteran teachers tell me this year that they are struggling. They just feel very dysregulated. We need to support each other so that we have the confidence and the strength to move forward and support our kids. So that's one thing that I would like to get out there this year is building a collaborative atmosphere at school among staff.
A couple of final questions for you. What keeps you coming back day after day?
I talked a little bit about this before, just seeing the progress that students make over time. And I like to have fun in my room. You know, we like to have fun. We like to joke around and just to have those moments where we can laugh and share fun moments. And I enjoy that with my students as well. But it is so very rewarding to see how far they can come and how persistent they are that they don't ever give up.
And one thing in visiting with you and reading about you is you truly fully recognize the impact that you and all educators can have on students. Talk about that responsibility and what it means to you.
Yeah. You know, I think the words that we choose to use with students is so very important. And we have the ability right now to grow their inner wealth, their self-confidence. And again, it goes back to, are they stubborn or are they persistent? You know, when we start to give some of those more negative connotation words, that's something that student is going to carry with them for a long time. But we need to think about the long lasting impacts that our words and our actions can have towards students. And so I'm really focused on that importance of building inner wealth and that self-esteem whenever I can. You know, I might have been just really frustrated with a kid a few minutes ago, but then I take that moment to say, you know what? 5 minutes ago, you were having a really tricky time. You took a few deep breaths and now look at you. You're ready to get back to work. What does that say about you? Like, you're able to self-regulate yourself. You're able to stay calm. You're able to show persistence and dedication in frustration. Like, that says a lot about you, right? And so that's what I want to grow in kids. That's what we need to focus on, kids. And whenever we're doing that, only good things are going to happen.
Dana Kosowski, special education teacher in Wapato Public Schools. Thanks for joining me on this episode of Education Mindset, and congratulations again on your being named a finalist for 2021 North Dakota Teacher of the Year. And after visiting with you, thanks for the work that you do.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
And that concludes our conversation with Dana Kosowski, a 2021 North Dakota Teacher of the Year finalist.
That was Wahpeton special education teacher Dana Kosowski in a conversation with Education Mindset podcast host Tom Gerhart. You can follow podcast episodes at ndunited.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more. Easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 9th. North Dakota voters split their votes at the polls, and the results were freshly announced during this day's Morning Sun in 1988.
Vice President George Bush won North Dakota as well as the nation when he defeated challenger Michael Dukakis. Bush earned 54% of the national vote after serving as vice president with popular President Ronald Reagan. But in the expanse of North Dakota, the Democratic candidates had clout to win elections. George Sinner retained the governor's office, easily handling the challenge of Leon Malberg, 60-40%. Democrat Sarah Vogel cemented her place in state history, becoming North Dakota's first woman elected as agriculture commissioner, gathering 45% of the vote against incumbent Kent Jones, Republican Keith Bierke, and independent Harley McLean. Quentin Burdick, longtime popular senator, handily triumphed over Republican challenger Earl Strindon. The winning incumbent was 80 years old at the time. Democratic House member Byron Dorgan triumphed over Steve Sidness, 2-1. Democrat Heidi Heitkamp won the state tax commissioner race, following in Kent Conrad's steps after he became a North Dakota senator 2 years previously. Earl Pomeroy, yet another Democrat, succeeded in the race for insurance commissioner, easily beating Margaret Bushy. The Democrats also won elections for treasurer, attorney general, and secretary of state, but it wasn't a clean sweep. Republicans did manage one statewide victory, as Robert Peterson held on to his position as state auditor. 1988 now seems very far in the past. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In his victory speech, Joe Biden thanked black voters for helping him to win the presidency. But was there support about how much they liked Biden or about how much they wanted President Trump out?
I just didn't hear myself included in a lot of the rhetoric in the last 4 years.
Black voters discussed the election and what a new administration could mean for them on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. You can find any of our shows at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, we'll feature an excerpt from this week's Prairie Pulse television show. Host Matt O'Lean will visit with Bruce Jovig, who, with his late co-author Hiram Drackey, wrote Innovative Entrepreneurs of North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, 150 Years of Impact. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.